Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, CEOs, founders and clinicians that are shaping the healthcare revolution in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I'm a founder and CEO of a health tech venture myself called PocDoc. We are transforming the way that people do blood tests, dramatically increasing access by allowing anyone with a phone to test themselves or be tested. And getting quantitative health check in minutes. PocDoc also support the show, so thank you very much to them. Also, just to start the show, we polled the numbers for the show and the geographic spread of listeners the other day. So I want to say specific thanks to everyone listening, and specifically thank you to our people, our fans in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kenya, Thailand, the United Arab Emirates, Vietnam, Australia, New Zealand, Colombia, Brazil, Argentina, and also to our big listener groups in the USA, UK, France, Germany, and Switzerland. We are now at listeners in 36 countries every month and counting. So thank you very much. This is in no small part due to the amazing team at UK Health Radio, led by Johan and Rafaela. They do an incredible job, incredible content across the station. And also, if you don't know, all UK Health Radio shows are now available on the UK Health Radio channel on Spotify and on all of the other podcast channels. So check them out. Again, thanks for listening live on UK Health Radio if you are, or you can catch us on Spotify on our own channel, Health Tech Hour, or on the UK Health Radio channel. Thanks again, obviously, if you're watching us on YouTube or listening on any of the other podcast channels. So on to this week. Now, last week we had Hamish Grierson from Thriver on, Thriver being one of the most, I guess, commonly known consumer diagnostics brands in the UK. So today is a really great continuation of our deep dive into diagnostics. We have one of the original pioneers of the UK diagnostics scene on the show, Chris Yates, the CEO of Abingdon Health, Abingdon Health are one of the leaders in the industry, particularly focused around lateral flow manufacturing. In the UK, they were one of the leading companies helping the government manufacture COVID tests at scale in the UK. And they've worked across a wide range of diseases and are held up as an example of UK innovation, UK life science success. And that culminated in IPO a couple of years ago. So really a lot to get into. Chris, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve. Delighted to be here.
Great. So let's jump into it, shall we? So obviously, you know, we're in the diagnostic space. I'm in the diagnostic space too. But let's try and kind of avoid going down a rabbit hole and like having people switch off until later in the show. So let's start with, I think what's really interesting for me, particularly around lateral flow, is, and we saw this when we started PocDoc, which was slightly before the pandemic, is that lateral flow wasn't necessarily a household term before the pandemic. But yeah, you started the company like way before, right? I mean, it was what, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, maybe more?
Just over 12 years ago. Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah.
And so give us the kind of origin story. Let's start there.
Yeah. So my colleague Chris Hand and I were the co-founders of Abingdon back in 2008. We'd previously worked together at a company called Cozart. Cozart was a drugs of abuse lateral flow company that had been founded in the 90s. I got involved. I was actually advised COSA on its flotation on the stock market. That's where I met Chris. The business floated around 2000, and we subsequently then sold that business in 2005. But that was a lateral flow testing company focused on drugs of abuse. And then Chris and I then set Abingdon Health up after that. And lateral flow has really been around since the 80s, and it was actually pioneered in the UK The first pregnancy tests were actually commercialized in the UK in the 80s. So we've got a huge amount of expertise actually in various companies and various people in the UK. And and Abingdon was really founded off the back of that back in 2008.
Okay. And what was it about Cozark? Did you say Cozark?
Yeah.
What was it about Cozark that you thought, you know what? I'm going to start a business like Cozark, but different. What I mean.
Yeah, I think lateral flow is obviously a technology that's got a huge amount of applications, and really both Chris and I saw that opportunity. Cozart was very focused on drugs of abuse, both in terms of screening but also in confirmation. So it actually provided quite an integrated service. So it also had back to the lab confirmation service as well as lateral flow testing. But both Chris and I saw the opportunity to really build something really focused on that technology and its applicability, not just in clinical, but across animal health, plant testing, and environmental testing. And that's really what we set out to do at Abingdon.
What's plant testing?
So, testing for plant pathogens. So,
Like things that kill plants.
potato virus,
Oh, wow.
Falciparum, Ralstonia, a whole bunch of different plant pathogens that you can test using the leaves or the plant material actually. So
Wow.
it just highlights the broad applicability of this technology.
And at the time, I guess in the early 2000s, like you say, pregnancy test, UK invention, clearly the first. Did you feel like the way people were thinking about it was sort of limited or like siloed, like and not thinking about the bigger picture or something?
Yes, I think there's always been a kind of a focus on laboratory testing, and I think actually, there is a role for both, self-testing, point of care testing, whether it's lateral flow or other methods, as well as laboratory testing. And I think an integrated approach is, certainly going forward is going to be really important. And I think from a technology point of view, we felt that, lateral flow testing really could stand up, compared to laboratory testing. I think COVID really was a catalyst for that, in all honesty. Prior to that, the application of lateral flow was broad, but I actually think post-COVID now, we're really seeing a paradigm shift in the use of lateral flow and the use of point of care and self-testing in general, actually.
Yeah, I would completely concur with that. And so, what was it like getting the company together at that point in time? You know, starting a company is always hard. I mean, I would assume it was no different for you. But what was it, you know, what was it like? Were you sort of really trying to educate people, having to really educate people on what the technology even did? Or did people sort of get it?
It was a bit of a journey. I think, as you said earlier, Steve, prior to COVID, actually, we had to explain what a lateral flow test was.
Yeah.
We always started by saying it's like a pregnancy test. But now, obviously, everybody knows what a lateral flow, and it's part of the vernacular, really, doing a lateral flow. I think back in the day, we started at Abingdon in 2008, just as the financial crisis was really kicking off. So the first couple of years were extremely challenging, and really, I think it's fair to say the business has changed, somewhat over the course of those, over that decade plus,
Sure.
in terms of what the proposition is. But yeah, the first couple of years were challenging. Lehman Brothers went bust. I remember we were kind of in the city at the time looking to raise some money as the financial crisis was happening. So it was extremely challenging times, and I think, we kept going, we kept plugging away. We obviously had to be very flexible in terms of our approach over the initial period, but ultimately it came together in terms of the proposition that we saw as for Abingdon, primarily being a contract manufacturer and developer for other businesses really, and leveraging our lateral flow experience and expertise across a whole range of different applications. But it's fair to say it took us a while to get to that point.
What, so let's dig into that slightly, which is what was the without, you know, don't need to get the old slide deck up or anything, but what was the evolution of where you sort of thought it was to where ultimately you sort of ended up figuring out, no, this is actually the thing that's gonna take off?
Yeah, I think some of the learnings that we had in the initial days is we spread ourselves too thinly, actually. So we tried to do too many things, it's fair to say, as a business. Whether it was, doing product development, working with third parties, almost becoming a quasi VC at times with
Oh,
other
wow.
entities. And I think, I actually came in as CEO about 8 years ago, and really, I'd been a pretty much a non-exec prior to that. And we really focused the business down on that contract service proposition.
Yeah.
Our mission has pretty much stayed the same throughout, which is really improving life by making rapid tests accessible to all. And that's a really important element and a really core, of what we do, obviously. But the way we kind of have applied that mission is now through helping our customers bring their products to market. And I
Yeah.
think really the learning from those early days is we try to do too many things at once. And so we've really focused down on what the core proposition is, what the core value proposition is of the business. And now we're starting to have, a fair degree of success in working with a large range of customers across a whole different range of sectors, actually.
That makes sense. I think just for the, we've got a broad church of people that listen to the show. Just again, jump in here, but broadly with it, I get maybe within any industry, but we're talking about diagnostics, there's kind of like two pathways, right? You're either the company that has the test and you own the test and you want to make that test or a series of tests. And sometimes you can make them in-house, sometimes you can't. Sometimes you get to a point where you no longer can make them in-house because the scale's too big. Or you're where Abingdon is now focused on, which is being that partner, manufacturing, production, development partner to those companies that may have come up with the original idea, proprietary IP, or however it ultimately works.
Yeah, absolutely. So we work with some, fantastic customers now, very, very bright people that have some brilliant ideas. And really, our role in that is to bring those ideas through to commercial success. And we can play, a very, very significant part in that, and pretty much, run the whole development process through to scale up and manufacture. Or we can play, an element of that role. So it really depends on what the customer's need is. But yeah, we see ourselves very much as lateral flow technology experts. It's lateral flow is all that we do,
Yeah.
deliberately. And what we try and offer is really holistic service offering. So, where the gaps are from a customer point of view is where we look to fill, really.
I think it's always interesting to see what like mainstream media kind of picks up, And I love all of these. We had Dr. Melanie Lee on from a society called LifeARC that are trying to give away like a £1.3 billion to cure motor neuron disease. I was talking to her about this, more about drugs, but it's a similar type of thing where someone somewhere in academia invents a test that can test for this or something. And then the BBC latches onto it. And you're like, right, congratulations. You managed to do that with like three samples in a lab under extremely controlled conditions. And congratulations, you published a paper. I'm like, I'm super happy for you. Don't get me wrong. But there's a huge journey from like there to actually getting it into the market at scale, right?
Absolutely. And I think, it takes time as well. It takes time
Yeah.
and effort and considerable funding, really, to
Yeah,
get
money.
from that idea all the way through. And you're absolutely right. At every stage in the journey, there are bumps in the road, there are challenges to address. And I think the one thing that we have is a lot of experience built up over, as we've just talked about, decades. And really, we can bring that to bear. And ultimately, we can speed that process up, really, for people, for
Well, I
customers.
think like what you can do is like if you don't know what you're doing and you don't embed, this is just my view, if you don't embed quality management and processes and operational oversight and regulatory, and if you're not really sophisticated in how to move a product through from research into development into production, you will waste a huge amount of time, which means you're going to waste a lot of money because as a startup, time is money. Basically, so like it's a you can save time, which means you can save money, which means ultimately it's around mission success for those companies.
It is, and I've got I spoke to a company last week, middle of last week in the US, that had actually launched their product in the US,
Oh,
but
yeah.
actually it was costing them more to make the product than they were, selling it for, and a lot of that is down to those initial steps in terms of how you plan, how you design, and how you, importantly, how you design for manufacture. And I think that that's really where we can add a huge amount of value, because otherwise, it becomes extremely challenging further down the line to redesign those processes. It becomes
become impossible if it goes too far, right? Because you don't, that company may not have enough funds to buy enough time to unpick everything that you need to unpick to then be able to make it at the scale you need to make it. Can get very scary.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's a bit like, did you ever, I can't remember which film it was. I can't remember, the name escapes me at the moment, but it was like an overview of the early days of Joy Division and New Order. And they, the first New Order album, or maybe it was an EP, where they wanted like this particular color scheme that was a code, it was like a visual code, and it cost them like twice as much as it did that they were selling it for. So it like bankrupted the record company, basically.
Well, I have a slightly duller other analogy than that, which is we went and we had a tour around the Jaguar Land Rover factory.
All
and
right.
It, and that factory was, that's been developed over decades and decades. Yeah. And so actually, that innovation has happened, since the 70s or, the 80s, whatever it might be. So, and every step you take takes you into a certain path or a certain direction. And so, it's absolutely critical, to really analyze and really look at your approach, from day one, really, because it will influence where you are on day 100 and day 1,000, et cetera. So yeah, it's an area that we can really support our customers and I think bring lots of learnings and lots of things that we've done in the past, bring those to bear, really.
So obviously there's like the big elephant in the room here, which is COVID, which we'll come on to, you know what I mean? We're going to get there. Like, don't worry. Like I would imagine for like 95% of the people on the planet, it was the first time that they realized what a lateral flow test was.
Yeah.
But before COVID, over the history of the company prior to COVID, what, I guess, and leading up to COVID, like the day before you heard about COVID, right? What did you think the most exciting opportunities in the space were? Like, what was getting you fired up the day before COVID was announced?
Yeah, we'd always talked a lot about the integration of lateral flow, with other technology, and we absolutely felt that whole area of health and well-being was going to come, and that was really a key area of a focus for us. But we've been talking about that probably for 5 to 7 years, in all honesty. So we still felt that was the most exciting development, but it was something that was taking quite a long time. So, certainly from our perspective, we saw that there was a opportunity for people to be empowered to manage their own health. We felt that there was pressure, probably not as much pressure as today on the health service. And we felt that there needed to be a kind of a shift, a paradigm shift. And we saw opportunities for that coming. But I think it's fair to say, that we saw that as a 5-year, 10-year time horizon.
Right. And what were the what was slowing it down? If we're like, what were the things that hadn't clicked into place?
I think firstly, from a consumer point of view, it was lack of understanding of lateral flow. And I think secondly, from a technology point of view, it was the need to integrate the various aspects of technology. Yep. And then thirdly, it's the whole kind of regulatory regime and also, adoption, barriers to adoption in public health, for example. So there are a number of different areas of challenge, really.
Yeah. I remember we closed our angel round and started our lab literally a few days before, before COVID hit. And so we were very at that time. And I remember having conversations with various angel investors and all these kind of people. And, I was shocked at the number of times people were like, I love the business. I love the sector. I think the technology is great. Blah, 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 blah. People are just not going to prick their finger, though.
Yeah.
And I was like, I respectfully beg to differ. There's like 60 million venous blood draws done to run a lipid panel annually, right? So what percentage of those do you think you might want to convert? But then, you know, you scroll forward a few months and then people are shoving all kinds of stuff up their nose and this, that, and the other. And it was just a complete, but it was interesting at that time, which is sort of what you're saying, to see what the prevailing opinion was around, because I always felt like it was one of those instances where people's personal opinion at that moment, which was, will you prick your finger? Do I want to prick my finger? The answer is always no. Yeah. I would, if I have a choice between not pricking my finger or pricking my finger, probably I would err on the side of not pricking my finger. So, but the choice is, if you prick your finger, you can access this huge range of health data. You can access treatment pathways. You can do it at home. You can do it yourself. You don't need a GP appointment, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And then suddenly it starts to feel really, really different. So I felt like people weren't really analyzing it in the context or in the round, you know?
Yeah, and actually, you know, I have three teenage boys, and actually, you know, those are the consumers of tomorrow. And in reality, they would see no difference in testing themselves, you know, doing a fingerprint test for COVID than doing a vitamin D test or some other form of wellness test. So I think also there's a generational shift here that yeah. we're kind of in the midst of. And that will really drive it.
I agree with you completely, but the some of our most avid users and happiest users are the people over 70.
Yeah.
And they're more than willing to crack on. Yeah. You know, and so I kind of feel like there's everyone at every level that has a level of comfort with it. But I think it's sort of, for too long there was this assumption that, oh, people won't do that, or people aren't interested in it, or they won't take that step. And it's like, no, I think they will, if they're provided with the right access at the right price, at the right convenience, in the right way, with the right pathway and the right motivation. I think that they will, you know?
And actually, I think it was things like Fitbit, the, you know, the Apple Watch, all of these different things that people were very happy and comfortable managing data, actually, right. In reality. They were very, and actually they wanted to do it. And I think that those almost were the precursor to, I think, what's going to come, which is people to being much more empowered and you know, to manage their own well-being over the next decade or so. But that was really what got me, is that actually people monitor the steps. People are absolutely keen to do it. And people engage with it. It's almost like a two-way process. They will change their behavior and lifestyle to basically improve their steps and therefore improve their well-being.
Well, yeah, I mean, my producer's shooting me death stares, so I have to go for an ad break in a second. But the I think what's really interesting is that you just generally psychology is that if you don't know where your baseline is, then you're less motivated to make changes because you can't track your progress. Like, that's not rocket science, you know, that's pretty standard. So yeah, why would health be any different?
Absolutely.
Right. We are going to go for our first commercial break. Okay. And then we will be back after a couple of minutes with Chris Yates, the CEO and co-founder of Abingdon Health. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, CEO and co-founder of PopDoc, and my guest this week, Chris Yates, the CEO and co-founder of Abingdon Health, who are one of the leading UK born and bred diagnostics companies. A leading light of the UK life science industry. So Chris, just before the break, we were kind of getting into some interesting stuff around people's propensity or interest in managing their own health, looking after their own health, monitoring their own, you know, biological levels, their biomarkers and so forth. What are some of the more interesting applications of lateral flow technology that allow people to do that, right? Because obviously there's a very clear use for lateral flow when it's an infection. You have it, you don't have it. But there's a much bigger universe of how it's being used.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think if I look from a sort of self-testing perspective, there is a whole raft of new developments happening in the area of fertility. For example, whether it's ovulation testing, whether it's and also areas in terms of women's health, such as in areas such as the menopause. We're seeing a lot of growth in other infectious disease testing as well. So we're seeing a number of new developments come through in sexually transmitted disease testing. And then if I look at the kind of the more kind of point of care area, I think we will also see lateral flow testing used, you know, in terms of monitoring patients and monitoring patients under treatment. I mean, we at Abingdon actually developed a test for multiple myeloma, which is a blood cancer, which mm-hmm. effectively tested patients that were going through treatment for multiple myeloma, checking whether they were in remission and relapse. And that was something that, you know, I felt was incredibly valuable, actually, because what it did was it allowed patients to either go back onto treatment relatively quickly or come off treatment relatively quickly. And obviously, there are clear advantages. If you're on chemotherapy, it's a really very tough treatment to be on. And if you don't need to be on it, if you can know that within an hour rather than knowing that within, you know, a week, that has got to be, you know, extremely, you know, valuable from a personal point of view. So I think we'll see continued growth in the areas of self-testing, whether that's infectious disease or other wellness tests, but also the use of lateral flow in, you know, in the hospital, you know, in clinic, whether it's to monitor patients, you know, under treatment, for example.
Cool. I would agree with all of that. So what, let's talk about the elephant in the room, I think, now at this point, the big C, COVID. And then I want to make sure that we spend some time towards the end going through your experience of IPOing the company, which it sounds like you IPO'd Cozark. So maybe you've done it twice, which is amazing. So let's go through that and that journey. And you know, why you make those choices. But when was the first point at which you realized that COVID wasn't just, you know, another random respiratory thing that would sort of, maybe there'll be some testing, maybe there won't, you know, when did you realize it was something different?
Pretty early on, actually. So I watch the news quite a lot, and I keep the track of what's going on, and I didn't monitor, you know, I did see quite a bit going on over the Christmas period and into January, and could kind of see the kind of warning lights really flashing. So much so that by the end of January, we'd actually put in the business a number of steps to basically, you know, whether it's you know, making sure people were using hand wash, etc., and doing things. And we were quite ahead of the game, actually, from that point of view. So we felt, you know, there was definitely something happening. It's obviously very difficult to predict what actually, you know, where we ended up in the end.
Yeah.
And in terms of the business, I have to be honest, we were like everybody else over the course of kind of, you know, February and March, it was a really uncertain time for the business. We were very unsure as to whether we would all go on furlough or whether we would continue as a business, you know, supporting various activities in COVID. So we felt early on there was an issue in terms of the impact on the business. That was obviously remained uncertain for a number of months, actually.
But when did you get in? Because I don't know quite how you want to get into it, but you ended up being one of the UK COVID test manufacturers, or at least contracted for that, until the government kind of maybe didn't hold up their end of the, you know, contract or something. So like, how did that kind of come to pass? And, you know, I mean, that itself must have been on the one hand amazing because you've got huge orders and you're partaking in sort of saving the country and doing all those kind of things. And then I guess quite disturbing, frustrating, and probably stressful when maybe they didn't do what they should have done. But I don't know.
Yeah, we were phoned, actually, and I might get the dates a bit wrong here, but it's sort of back end of March by Professor Sir John Bell. He literally phoned the office.
The big dog, Big John.
And asked if we could help. And, you know, I remember my operations director at the time, Michael, picked up the call, and then he relayed it to my chairman Chris and myself, and within a few hours we were on calls, and we were basically asked, can we help support and develop a test, an antibody test.
They came in first with antibody.
Yeah, and that's what we did. So we literally turned the whole company into a development engine to make an antibody test. And we also were asked to build a supply chain. And so pretty much since, from then onwards, from kind of April through to June, July, when we actually got the product CE marked, it was, all
which for was it through, did you get an emergency use on that? Because that's an unbelievable timeline. For people that don't know, that is probably a world record in some way, shape or form.
I have to be honest, the team were phenomenal.
That's incredible. 3 months.
And
maybe
they
less.
It was incredible. And they were working, we had R&D teams working a morning shift and an evening shift. They were working the weekends. Like, no, I'm not a scientist, so my role was supporting. So whether it was...
They were like, Chris, do not touch this.
No, exactly.
Get out.
Don't put that white coat on. Keep that. So, and actually they did a phenomenal job to get something CE-marked, basically by July in a matter of a few months. And
that must have been one of the first ones, right? Give or take.
So ours was, there were a number of antibody tests that were already on the market, which were IgM, IgG tests. And ours were the specific IgG test. And the reason actually we were brought in is because the government had bought, a number of these, other tests. And they really couldn't find a use case for them. So they couldn't really work out how to use them. So we developed this test in record time. We brought together a consortium of other UK companies who would manufacture the test. And it was a massive effort, actually, and a tremendous effort by the team. And I'm very proud of the effort they made because, we stood up to be counted, bluntly.
Yeah, that's incredible. And so what was the kind of thesis at the time the government was excited about with antibody testing? What was it tracking the spread, presumably, in some way, shape or form?
I think it was, again, I'm not guessing, but my assumption is that it was about, checking whether people had a degree of immunity and therefore could go about their daily lives. But obviously, at a certain time, the government switched tack, really, and moved on to antigen testing.
Yeah, big time.
Antibody testing kind of went, slightly by the wayside after a period of time. And, we were involved with other commercial entities that were developing antigen tests as well. So we had pretty much once we'd done the development of the antibody test, we had a couple of programs that we were working on, with customers on the antigen test side. But I'm really proud of our efforts, actually. And, whilst it didn't kind of work out exactly how we wanted it to, and, there are lots of challenges and issues that followed that. But, ultimately, when we were asked to stand up and deliver something, we did so. And I think actually most UK companies were in the same boat as us, including our competitors. We were asked to help and support, and we did so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone would disagree. It was like a, united front, right? Everyone had to help. So one thing, and maybe you saw it, but I never did. And the research might exist. I just haven't gone looking for it. But because there was a huge amount of chat at the time around, if you can quantify someone's antibody levels, you might be able to determine, what that natural immunity actually is. But I don't think if that necessarily was ever published and they actually connected antibody level with level of immunity necessarily. But I don't know if you saw anything, because I have not come across it.
There was some work done by the WHO in that area. And I know the government were also looking into it as well. That wasn't really a big focus of our own internal efforts. It was more to do with, developing a kind of working assay and then scaling up the manufacture of that. So, but I think, as I said, over the course of 2020 and mainly in 2021, it, obviously the government switched its efforts to antigen testing.
Yeah, and like big time, and you know, important. What I thought was interesting, which I don't know, was a bit of a footnote on the whole thing, but you know, the Inova tests that came in big time, they didn't even get FDA approval. They didn't get through FDA. And I was, when I saw that, I was like, okay, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I, again, it's difficult for me to comment on that. I'm not, I wasn't party to the evaluations done at Porton Down on the tests. But I think, you know, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned, isn't there, from COVID and the way it was.
I hope so. Bloody hell.
And I hope those lessons are learned. And I do think one of them is, you know, supporting and building up a, you know, a domestic, you know, diagnostic industry in general. I think it's something that, you know, there may well be a pandemic in the next 10 to 20 years. Obviously, everybody hopes there isn't. And I think we need our own surety of supply of those tests. And
yeah,
that means that, you know, whichever government it is needs to invest in, you know, R&D and support a domestic industry in a way that, the for example, the US is doing, you know, with you know, supporting its domestic diagnostic industry and building it out and has been for the last couple of years.
I think that the political situation, without getting too much into politics, is very tricky, obviously, at the moment, you know, because they've cut. Have they still cut the R&D tax credit? I think that's still cut, is it? Or is it reduced? I can't remember where it got ended up or whether they U-turned on it. But for everyone listening, if you're an innovative company, life science company, companies generating lots of, you know, scientific development, progress and so forth, you can get a tax credit, which is actually quite meaningful and quite important for probably all companies in life sciences, high tech, engineering, all of these things. And the government, I think, maybe they U-turned on it, but they certainly published that they were going to cut it. I think they were going to halve it. I'm not sure whether that went through. Have you heard anything?
I'm not completely clear as to where exactly we've got to on that.
But that's like, I think that's kind of, but then at the same time, the government says that they want the UK to become this kind of like, you know, or continue to be, or even more improve as a beacon of, you know, scientific innovation. So I think it's going to be kind of interesting to see how that one plays out, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
You know, we've got some amazing businesses. Some, you know, we've got, obviously from an academic point of view, we've got world leading universities. We've got the NHS. We've got a triumvirate of, you know, of entities that, you know, working together could create something extremely special, actually. So I think it is important for the government, you know, to really invest and support. And I think for me, it's come back to this surety of supply. You know, we need to ensure that we have a level of control of our own destiny. And because we saw what happened with things like PPE during the pandemic.
Oh, my goodness.
That people, you know, outbidding each other for that. And actually, I think it's important that we have a bit more control over our own destiny, really.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make any real sense to me that we would just be like importing tests from China that we can make. Mm-hmm. Like, and I know we did both, like, don't get me wrong, you know, and I think I agree with you. I'm not worried about, I think our universities generate a huge amount of extremely valuable intellectual property, scientific innovation. I think at that, like, academic level, it's really quite strong from what I can tell, you know, from sort of given our population and things like that. I'm concerned about the transition of that research into real world application, the funding, the ability to take that research and then apply it.
Yeah.
That's where you need a huge amount of funding, and funding at the right time and support at the right time, you know, and that's where government, I think, has to come in and play a role as best as it can, because you can see also when there's like negative economic headwinds, private capital dries up too. So it can't be like, oh, well, you know, the government can't fund everything. The, you know, private markets have to take care of themselves. Well, what happens if the private markets are struggling? Then this stuff just doesn't get done. And then you end up in a bit of a vicious cycle.
Yeah. And I think these, you know, the diagnostic industry has got huge export potential. easier to look at it. You know, if I look at our customer base at the moment, it's, you know, more than 50% of our contract customers are overseas. You know, we do a lot of work in the Middle East, a lot of work in the US, and obviously mainland Europe as well. And so there's huge export potential, huge manufacturing potential. So it's you know, there's potential taxable, you know, tax benefits, you know, in the future from that. So I think it's almost feels like diagnostics is becoming a, you know, a critical infrastructure, really.
I would agree with that, because it helps the health service. Yeah. It provides jobs, it provides growth, and it's export friendly, massively export friendly, I would say. I think we're getting onto a subject which we spoke to Richard Phillips from the ABHI. He came on about a year or so ago talking about Brexit. Again, not looking to get political, but I think it's kind of interesting. It'd be interesting to see how this plays out, because if you look at stuff like in the Middle East, if you look at Saudi Arabia, for example, they will only accept medical devices that have got FDA approval or CE marking. Or something else. I can't remember what it is. Maybe it's just FDA or CE. But like, that means that if you're just UKCA marked, then you won't be able to go and export Saudi Arabia. You need to go and get it approved in another market.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I do wonder why we have the different, you know, regulatory processes. It seems to be logical that we all follow one process, and actually, if that's the FDA, or if it's, you know, it's the rules are the same across the board, it feels it creates an industry, you know, in its own right, really. Whereas actually, simplicity would seem to be the answer. Well,
but also, like, if you're looking to, again, with that, let's just say we're not talking about sacrificing standards. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about saving huge amounts of time and money for companies that are producing quality things. Mm-hmm. To avoid having to just replicate and duplicate the same thing, basically. Yeah. So Switzerland did an interesting thing. Shout out to Switzerland, all our Swiss listeners. They have, because they obviously have this thousands of bilateral agreements with the EU, they've obviously accepted CE marking, but they've also just announced that they'll accept FDA as well.
Yeah.
So, which I think is really clever, because what you're not saying is not a free for all. You're just saying, we recognize the FDA standard is really high standard, and we'll accept anything that's been through the FDA. Like, super pragmatic.
Yeah. And maybe that's where the UK will end up in the end. I don't know. And, you know, from an Aberdeen point of view, we provide a regulatory service to our customers. So one of the key things at the moment is helping customers with UKCA marking. You know, you need a legally responsible person in the UK. We also help customers with CE marking, with the transition to IVDR. We're helping customers, in, you know, with the FDA. We're doing pre-submissions, but ultimately, it would make everyone's lives a lot easier. And certainly, you know, if I look just from the UK point of view, it would make life a lot easier if it was a case of either CE marking or FDA, like the Swiss. I think that would be logical, actually.
I think that's how they have to go. I think they've just been so busy with a whole bunch of other things. Yeah. But I just can't see it. All it's going to take is for one big drug developer or one big medtech person to make one super special device available somewhere else.
Yeah.
Then it will kind of go, you know, like there'll be one kind of shining example that will hit the front page of the Daily Mail, you know, somebody couldn't get their treatment because, and then, you know, then it will kind of change. Because it doesn't make any sense. Right. We've got to go for our final commercial break. And then when we get back, we're going to talk about IPO and selling a company, going public, and all of that good stuff. So we will be back after this final break with today's guest, Chris Yates, the CEO and co-founder of Abingdon Health. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Chris Yates, the CEO and co-founder of Abingdon Health. Right. So you've got Abingdon Health. It's like doing what it's doing. You're cracking on. And then at some point you're like, right, we're going to IPO. Like, what was the thought process leading up to that? why was IPO the right move for you guys versus continue to kind of, I don't know, raise money or grow, or like, why was that the right, you know, talk us through that.
Yeah, absolutely. So actually prior to COVID, we were looking at doing a growth capital round. And actually we were, the main reason for that was investing in automated kit. So right. I'd actually been out kind of so October, November, 2019, talking to the various suppliers and looking at how we could, you know, invest in our automation. And the reason for that is we felt that that was the way we could compete and really succeed, was investing in automated manufacturing, making ourselves as efficient as possible, and therefore being as competitive as we could, you know, to support our customers. COVID then came along, and actually, I suppose from a sort of size of capital raise, you know, we were looking at a larger raise, really, again, to invest in our, you know, automated manufacturing facilities. So we'd had experience of floating a company on AIM before, as I said, which was Cozart. I was actually the advisor on that float. So I previously worked in the city, right, and advised Chris Hand, who was the CEO at Cozart, who's now my chairman, on the float. That float had gone well. It had raised about 6 million for the company. And then Cozart had gone on and done 4 acquisitions on AIM, raised a little bit more money on AIM. And then ultimately, you know, after kind of a number of years on AIM, the business was sold to a consolidator. And so it had been pretty successful outcome, actually, for investors. The exit multiples were like 4 times revenue, 40 plus times EBITDA. Right. And a number of the original investors, the VCT investors, had made, you know, really good returns. And so we felt it was a, you know, it was a good route, actually, and one that we were experienced in. And that was the reason we went down the, you know, the AIM route, to raise the capital, to really invest in the business, to scale up our manufacturing. And you know, obviously at the time it was to support our manufacturing for COVID. Ultimately, you know, actually it's going to support our manufacturing for pretty much everything apart from COVID. But that was the reason, really the reason for considering the float.
Okay. And how did it go? Because did you do it in the middle of COVID?
Yes, we floated in December 2020. So
wow, like in the depths.
Yeah, it was really challenging.
To say the least.
Because we were doing it, obviously we were in the midst of really kind of scaling up our manufacturing, dealing with the supply chain for the antibody test. And on top of that, we were running the IPO process. And the IPO process is, you know, it's a lengthy process. So it's about, you know, 4 or 5 month process. And during the course of November, we had 2 weeks of investor meetings. And it was
virtual. Were you allowed to do them in person?
No, it was all on Teams or Zoom.
It must have been exhausting.
It was 80 investor meetings over 2 weeks.
All on Zoom.
Extraordinary. I mean, it was.
Although I will say though,
yeah,
it meant that you could do 80. If you had to do 80 investor meetings in person,
yeah,
that would have taken forever.
Yeah, it would have been impossible. So it was really efficient use of time, and it was a really intense, you know, period over the course of November, and you know we managed to raise the money that we needed to support, you know, our growth ambitions for the business. So from that point of view, you know, the IPO was a success. Clearly, you know, we've had some challenges in terms of, you know, the share price and the performance of the price over that of the period subsequent to that. But from an IPO point of view, you know, it was good to get it done, and it was a good it's a stepping stone, really. You know, I don't see that as a kind of flag waving exercise. It allowed us to continue to grow and improve the business.
Yeah, and I think that's what people don't really realize about an IPO is that obviously for earlier investors and things like that, it's an exit, right? It is they might sell some or potentially all of what they put in, but they might have been in for a really long time. So that's like fair enough. They want to get their money out. But for the management team, it's not the end. In fact, it's basically the beginning of a new journey, you know, and hopefully a very exciting one with lots of other opportunities, because that's kind of the point. But it's not the end.
No, it's not. And, certainly from my perspective, I've never sold a share in the company. And in fact, at the last placing we did in December 2021, I actually invested again in the company. So for me, it was absolutely a stepping stone for the business. But on a personal level, our ambitions for this business are really high, and within that, the lateral flow industry has got huge growth potential, and that's our focus. So,
And what, well, let's talk about that. So future-wise, what's up next for Abingdon Health or the industry or both?
we are very much focused on our existing business model, which is our CDMO business, and
Which
that's
is, for everyone, contract manufacturing.
so that's contract development and manufacturing. And really our focus is to continue to kind of grow and expand that. In addition, we've launched a range of self-tests under the Abingdon SimpliTest brand. And that really is a range of tests that we've launched on our own e-commerce site, and also on Amazon as well. And we're also supplying it through various distribution partners. And I think And that's really going to be our continued focus for the foreseeable future. We see great growth potential in both of those areas. Lateral flow, we see huge potential. It's a, you know, the industry as a whole is something like a $10 billion industry, and is growing at really good, high single digits. And as we talked about earlier, COVID has been a, the silver lining of the dark cloud of COVID for is the Is it acting as a catalyst really for the expansion of testing into lots of different areas?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly changed the consumer's perception. I think it's changed healthcare systems' perception of the value of lateral flow, changed, like healthcare organizations and things like that. I mean, I still think that there's work to be done around how to digitize what's effectively an analog product. You know, I think that that's the next kind of frontier. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
No, I agree. I think it needs to be integrated into an end-to-end solution, and I think there are obviously there's a lot of work going on, as you well know, in
Yeah.
that area. And I think lateral flow is one element of it. And as we talked about right at the start, it's that integration piece I think is going to be the critical success actually for the use of diagnostics, whether it's in self-testing or point-of-care environments. We're involved in that as well. We've got AppDx, which is an algorithm that reads lateral flow strips. But there's also, and I listened to the interview with Hamish last week.
Yeah.
There's the whole kind of GP element, and there's the whole kind of clinical care. Rather than putting pressure on the healthcare service with people turning up with positive lateral flow tests, ultimately we need to provide a more
Well,
holistic offering actually.
I think that a really good example is some sexual health tests. So, for example, chlamydia, really simple one, just get the antibiotics. Right? I think there's some other ones where, there's different pathways due to the seriousness or due to what they might mean or follow on or complications or advice around medication. But that one for me is a clear one, a bit like UTI testing. Like, weirdly, actually, the NHS just pulled their funding for that. And they're just basically telling pharmacists if you present with two or three symptoms, verbal symptoms, they're just giving the antibiotics. They don't even do a test anymore.
And I think pharmacists and pharmacy chains have got a huge role to play in this going forward,
Yeah.
in terms of taking some pressure off primary care actually, and also from a it's commercially it's the right thing for pharmacists to do as well. So I think they can provide that integrated solution in many cases actually, and I think that's got to be the way forward.
Yeah, I think so. And particularly with the funding strain, like I can't remember what I read, but I can't remember what it was off the top of my head, but it was some scary figure about the cut in funding or the closures of sexual health clinics during the pandemic. It was like a frighteningly high number, And like this is a really classic example of where if you can have, if you can figure out the digital piece of it to make sure the pathway's tracked, potentially, but a lot of those sexual health clinics, you go in and you just get the antibiotics anyway. Like it's not like there's a digital pathway. But if you can do that, then I think that that's a classic area where it can help without a doubt.
No, I totally agree.
Right. So we've got a couple of minutes left in the show. It's been great to have you on. Just before we go, as a kind of a multi-time entrepreneur in the diagnostic space, what would your advice be to entrepreneurs, scientists, founders? What keeps you going? How do you kind of stay on your mission and get up and do this every day?
I think the first thing actually is understand what your mission is. It's understanding why you get out of bed in the morning, because, you know, it's extremely challenging, and we're in extremely challenging times, you know, in terms of funding, etc. And I think from a personal point of view, it's always good to refer back to that, what your mission is and why you do what you do. And, you know, and ultimately, you know, for many people in this industry, it's they want to make a difference and they want to improve people's lives. And, you know, when you're in your rocking chair in your 80s talking to your mate and you're saying, well, what did you do for a living? That's what you want to talk about, is how you improved, you know, testing in a certain area, improve people's lives. So I think the first thing to do is make sure your mission is defined and you stick to it. And the second thing is resilience. You know, we are going through tough times. I think it's important to be resilient, stick to your guns, keep moving forward. And you know, certainly my experience working in small growth companies is there's loads of challenging days, but they only last a day. You sleep and then you get on and the next day is different. And I think that for me is a really important thing to note is, you know, keep resilient and keep going, basically.
I love it. I love it, Chris. On that note, thank you very much for coming on the show. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week. If you missed it live, then feel free to get any of the shows on Spotify or other podcast channels. Keep an eye out for the YouTube. But thank you very much. That was Chris Yates, CEO of and co-founder of Abingdon Health. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for listening.
So don't leave me alone. You said you like my eyes and you like to make them roll. Treat me like a queen, now you got me feeling thrown. I'm looking at myself when you get close to me. Baby, my tongue goes numb. Sounds like bleh, bleh, bleh. I don't want no one else. Baby, I'm in too deep. Here's a little song I wrote. It's about you and me. I'll be honest. Looking at you got me thinking nonsense. Was in my stomach when you walk in.